Welcome to The Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. This is the podcast where we talk about politics, geopolitics, economics, culture, ideas. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want my weekly newsletter and the work of our brilliant columnists like Tim Marshall and Maggie Pagano, Bruce Anderson, Adam Bolton, and many more, become a subscriber by going to the site www.reaction.life and signing up. Today, I'm joined by Tim Marshall. Welcome.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a while, for which many apologies, but it's good to be here.
Great. Tim, let's start with the subject of your column for Reaction last week, which generated quite a bit of response, I think it's fair to say, on social media. And it was a very effective, calm explanation of why those who are campaigning for, supporting the campaign run by the Houthis are, let's put it politely, being very, very foolish. What motivated you to write it?
It was the attack on the ship True Confidence mid of last week, which killed two Filipino sailors and a Vietnamese sailor. And it just brought back the memories of during the marches in January, February, and ongoing, when there's this new chant that people have come up with, Yemen, Yemen, make us proud, turn another ship around. And I just thought that the lack of understanding of who the Houthis are and the taking pride in firing the missiles at these ships should be called out for what it is, which is mostly a total ignorance about the Houthis. And worse, those that do know who they are, but simply because they have joined in the campaign against Israel, you can excuse it. And my argument is that you can't. Because, and again, yeah, on social media, naturally, people crawled all over it and you know, gave grave insults. But one of the arguments, and this is the lack of knowledge and critical thinking by some people, one of the pushbacks was, well, it's all Israel's fault. But the article was about the Houthis not just firing missiles at ships. It was about the legal system they've introduced in the areas they control, in which the legal system last month condemned 9 men to be either stoned to death or crucified because they were homosexuals. They've reintroduced slavery. They're trying to make sure women can't drive. You know, the list is long. Child soldiers, they are one of the world's worst offenders in recruiting child soldiers. And you have this big litany of depravity. And the idea that people are running through the streets of London shouting in support of them is somewhat stomach-churning. And the idea that it's Israel's fault that they're crucifying gay people. And the True Confidence, this ship, not only did they kill 3 civilians, but the True Confidence was on its way from China to Saudi Arabia carrying steel. Absolutely nothing to do with the Israeli-Gaza conflict. They were at it again over the weekend, and the chant was heard again across the weekend. I'll admit it was something of a controlled rant, but I just can't stand that sort of whataboutery, hypocrisy, and ignorance.
Why do you think there is such ignorance about what you described? I mean, is it those chanting it? I suppose it's difficult to know definitively what their motives are, but Is it ignorance? Is that your guess, or something darker?
I think, well, for some of them it's something darker. For something it's something sort of psychological. I mean, you know, it is hard, of course. You know, you don't know each individual person, but there will be those that get a real kick out of doing something. You know, I mean, it's a vibrant feeling being out on the street and doing something for what you believe in. For some, it's fashionable. I remember way, way back when I was late teens, early 20s, there were all these nearly always middle-class students who would come out on a Friday night with a donkey jacket on and Doc Martens, even though it was Friday when you should be getting dressed up, because they were sort of, it was cool to be relative and to be showing solidarity and all that. And I think many of them are that sort of people that they, you know, it's fun to be involved. There's those that simply aren't smart enough or are prepared to take the trouble to find out who it is that they are hand in hand with. And those are the ones who have literally no idea who the Houthis are, what is going on in Yemen, and the fact they crucify gay people. But if they are against evil Western values, consequently, I must be with them. And there's a bit of intersectionality going on there. And then there's those that may know full well, but don't care about the things, the depravity that the Houthis get up to, because the greater cause is worth it. They are the worst of it, and possibly amongst the organizers. So I just, we can't know for sure, but I think there's those various strands going on.
On the conflict itself, what's your what's your understanding of this? Has now been running for some time. It's obviously a major problem for global trade routes and for shipping. Is it any closer to being some form of resolution? I mean, obviously the allied countries have engaged in all manner of strikes in recent months. Is it making a difference?
You look at the charts of missile attacks, and they have diminished quite considerably. They began in early November, began to peak December, early January. The various countries got involved then, notably the States and junior partner Britain, but other countries, France and Spain and Italy under their own flags. And that has significantly reduced because they have to shoot and scoot. They have to fire the missiles and then get moving quickly, which limits their abilities. Perhaps the missile stocks are going down. It's incredibly expensive. They are firing $200,000 missiles here. So it has had an effect, but will it stop it? I doubt it very much. The Houthis are very, very, very resilient, quite prepared to take the casualties on their side from the return missile strikes. So, and of course, are funded and armed by Iran, and Iran has the means to bring in more missiles. So, no, I don't think that the Allied powers can actually stop this.
What about the Israel-Gaza situation itself? And I wanted to ask you about the phrase two-state solution. In various discussions I've had recently, this is, I think it's almost taken for granted that in the West, and it's certainly the approach of the UK government, that the two-state solution as a potential resolution to this conflict, that's the goal, that's the aim. But it's fascinating talking to Israelis about this, is that it is now regarded as virtually impossible, given the way that this has unfolded since October the 6th and the horrendous attacks on October the 7th. And there seems to be, if not a consensus, there seems to be an astonishing amount of unanimity across Israeli politics about this. Is there's almost a dialogue of the deaf on this, isn't there, between Western diplomats using the phrase as code for long-term resolution of the problem and the way in which the Israelis increasingly see this as impossible?
There's a lot to unpack there. By the way, I should also, before I get into it, say I wrote a column for you about 3 weeks ago saying that they had 3 weeks because the Israelis were saying they were going to go into Rafah by Ramadan unless there was resolution. And I wrote this article explaining how they would do it and this, that, and the other. But they're clearly very, very nervous about doing this during that Ramadan because it is on hold, that operation. And I think what has happened is that I don't think we fully understand the importance of Ramadan in Islam and the heightened emotions that there are during the month. I mean, it's not just Christmas and steroids. Christmas in the West for very few people is about the birth of Jesus. It's about presents. It's different throughout the Middle East. It's a time of reflection. It's a time of heightened emotion. It's a time of resolution and forgiveness and all those things. And so to have that going on during Ramadan, I think the Israelis realize that the West Bank could go up in flames very, very easily. Sorry, two-state solution. It's been dead since around about 2000. No, let me rephrase that. on life support since around about 2000, but it took a lot of people, best part of two decades, to catch up on that. That's both psychological and actually physical. It's psychological in that, and this is an Israeli perspective, they, from their perspective, they left Gaza and all they got was rockets, which began to chip away at the idea that if there is a two-state solution, there is peace. And the continuing suicide bombings. And every time there is one, the center and center left shrank and continue to shrink. Simultaneously, the demographics of Israel is that the religious population is growing faster than the nominally secular population. And their parties are almost always on the far right. And so they've been growing. So all that has happened. Then there's the Bantustanization of the West Bank, where the growth of the settlements, which has accelerated through this century, makes it difficult to have contiguous territory for the Palestinians in their state. And you've put all that together, and then comes the October 7th, which just about kills it on that side. But the horror of October 7th, and indeed the horror in Gaza subsequently, has caused everybody to try to resurrect the two-state solution. With the Saudis, for example, saying, yeah, you know, we are prepared to make peace with Israel, but now the price is two-state. UAE, we will pay for the reconstruction of Gaza, but you need to be moving. The Americans under Biden, et cetera, et cetera.
And also Cameron, David Cameron, yes, as British Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron.
Yeah, who is being left alone by Prime Minister Sunak to plough his furrow, which I think is interesting. I mean, I don't think Sunak's particularly interested in foreign policy anyway, and Cameron clearly is an experienced hand. So it's now back on the table. And in pure theoretical terms, not taking into consideration politics, it is so doable. You can pull some settlements and settlers out. You can create corridor roads. You can still have something like at least four-fifths of the West Bank. I mean, I'm not talking about the morality and the rights and the wrongs. I'm talking about, you know,
the logistics.
Physically.
Yeah.
And it could. And then you could even build a two-lane, four-lane highway, the 23 miles or so from the West Bank across what is most of it scrub ground. If you come down the bottom of the West Bank into the south of Gaza, you could create, I mean, it would have to be fenced off, or you could build a tunnel, even though that would be interesting. So you could have contiguous territory connected, you know, the two Palestinian entities connected as one. But first of all, you've still got two different political entities in those two entities. Secondly, you have, and this is one of the biggest problems, on both sides, you have absolutists, maximalists. You have on the Israeli side that it's always a coalition government, and in modern times, to have a coalition government, you need the right-wing religious parties. The moment this two-state solution was agreed and then put to the cabinet would resign and the whole thing would collapse. And the Israeli government knows that, and Netanyahu. And so on one side, you have to have a growth of the center, that's the Israeli side, and a coalition that could be put together that would accept this. And that's very difficult. On the other side, you're not going to kill the idea of Hamas. Possibly you might you might not grow Hamas, but you'll grow radicalism. And radicalism, Hamas believe, and again, I've written about this, that the land between the river and the sea is a wafq, which is land, holy land, given by Allah to Muslims, in which only Muslims can rule. So on the other side as well, you've got these religious extremists with their own ideas about what God wants. You know, it's sort of a vaguely mirror image of the Israeli religious far extremists. And they will always try to collapse things, either if they're in power through politics or if they're out of power through terrorism. So I don't see that we're going to get past that. But I do agree that we should be, the powers that be, should be trying to get past that those difficulties and actually try to get a solution. Because if there was, the leaders right across the Middle East, who've never really cared about the Palestinians, will come to terms with Israel. Many of the Palestinians will come to terms with not getting everything they wanted. I mean, Jerusalem would have to be divided, etc. And that would just leave the extremes, which could be managed. So I have three scenarios for you, Ian. One, a one-state solution, which everybody lives in peace and happiness, and even if they're not Christian, sings Kumbaya.
Let's say that's unlikely. Yep.
I would say that's unlikely. Two, a two-state solution. I think that is possible, but unlikely, if not as unlikely as the first example. And then you have the third option, which is what the Israelis went for once they lost hope in those that wanted it, a two-state solution. And that is you manage the situation. The last thing I'd say, and forgive me for such a long answer, Ian.
Not at all.
The last thing I'd say on that is that the October 7th act has severely damaged Netanyahu's, who led this idea of managing it, because they've been reminded horribly that you can't manage it forever without incredible repercussions. I'm not justifying it. I'm seeking to partially explain it. And so I heard what you said in the introductory remarks to the question, that it is dead in the Israeli mind. But there is also this idea now that, hang on, we tried to manage it, and what happened was the worst massacre of Jews since World War II.
Yep.
And from that germ could grow a greater idea. Do I think it will? Probably not. I still think managing may be the end game, which is sad, but quite possible.
You've absolutely got to the heart of it there. This is the paradox, isn't it? That Netanyahu's policy fails. I mean, the calamity, the disaster of
It did. Yes.
the barbarism on October the 7th. The politics, it's a long tail of politics, a policy in which you could essentially just regard Gaza as boxed in, controlled by Hamas, annoying, sometimes a threat, terrorist entity, but you could also have an economic relationship with the territory brokered by others, and that the Palestinians could never really get their act together. Either in Gaza or on the West Bank, and the situation just kept on. One year rolls into the next, and it's just managed in that
It's
way.
exactly what happened, Ian. And at the time, Israel's economy was doing mostly quite well, and they really did lock the door and throw the key away. As far as they were concerned, people didn't even really think about
Sure,
Gaza,
but from an
except every now and again when a rocket comes over, and then they were absolutely forced to. So, I mean, the liberal mind wants, and I want, this germ of an idea that that didn't work, there has to be a better solution, which is the two-state solution, grows and reaches fruition. But the liberal mind doesn't always win out, and they could have the other idea, which is that, we must be even stronger than we were. And as an aside, this is one of the reasons why the Israelis are going in such force. It's cold and calculating, but they have to reestablish throughout their region. You don't mess with us. I mean, it is horrible, cold and calculating, but it is the law of the schoolyard bully. And I'm not calling Israel a schoolyard bully. It's the schoolyard where weakness is attacked, and so you always have to show that you're not weak, and that is one of the things that they're trying to do. So it might not be the sort of liberal, the way ahead is to come together. It could be the way ahead is to make sure it can't happen again via the military side of things.
I mean, the other dimension is that Israel did not occupy Gaza in that period. Hamas was in charge of Gaza.
Yes.
Aid was obviously misspent, to put it politely, in terms of building up the tunnel network.
Millions
and armaments.
And tens of millions of dollars.
Simultaneously, we've discussed it before, the program of indoctrination and institutionalized anti-Semitism.
Yeah, seen it with my own eyes. It's quite disgusting.
All of that then played out, and then resulted in the barbarism of October the 7th. But I suppose the paradox is, as you describe it, is that if you ask Israeli friends about this, you say, well, if not a two-state solution, I can understand, given everything that's happened, the skepticism. If not a two-state solution, then what? And as you say, it may be some form of new policy of managing the way through it. But I suppose we're not going to resolve it today, but it's difficult to see precisely what the contours of that are. And it's not then going to, and Israel will know this, it's not then going to satisfy critics, in people who are marching, and well, they're not going to be satisfied with much at all, other than many of them want the destruction of the state of Israel, it seems, based on their chants. So that still continues in the West, and you have the other dimension, which is war in the North potentially coming, and potentially some sort of reckoning with Iran. So tell us how that war in the North, if it happens, and it seems pretty likely by some readings, what would that look like?
Okay. Firstly, I just needed to go back to, again, during your question, you said Gaza was not occupied. And I agree with you, but there are legal definitions in which you could argue it is occupied, in that the controlling power controls the borders and says what can and can't come in. And, and there are legal readings that says that is an occupation. Now, I have been in Gaza many times. I don't get upset if somebody says it's occupied, even if I don't agree with it. What really winds me up is this, that it's a giant concentration camp, because I have been in the water parks there, which I don't recall from the Warsaw ghetto. I've been in the high-end hotels there, which are very, very nice, which I don't recall from the Auschwitz. I've been in some really fancy restaurants, ditto, Dachau. You know, there's a lot of money there, car showrooms. Yeah, not now, and it's awful what has happened. But, yeah, I really take umbrage when I hear the word concentration, open-air concentration camp, as I said, water theme parks.
Yeah.
Right, moving on. Yeah, the war in the North. There's still about 60,000 Israelis displaced inside Israel, and it's harming the economy up north, especially fruit growing and wine growing industries, which are not massive, but you know they're important. And the Israelis needing to go back, it's quite a strain on the economy. But they are getting rockets fired at them almost every day, mostly by Hezbollah, but also by, there is a Hamas element inside Lebanon, and other groups. And what the Israelis are saying, and they respond militarily, and they're saying you need to go back across the Litani River in Lebanon, which is about roughly 18 miles from the border. Now, there are long-range missiles, but Hezbollah's not going to burn them for no reason. You know, it's all very calculated, what they send across, how big it is, and where they send it. It's very calibrated on both sides. But at some point when Gaza's finished, or the major combat operations, I should say, are finished in Gaza, Israel's gaze will turn northwards to try to settle that. Mm. You know, either you stop and we can send the 60,000 home, or we will make you stop, at which point things get very, very tense. And I mean, you're probably getting your readings from various places. I'm far from convinced it will happen, but I am sure that there is a danger of it happening mid to late spring. So what does it look like? It doesn't have to draw Iran in. I don't think, but Hezbollah would have a really difficult time, because I was there in 2006 in the Israeli Hezbollah war, and it's an important distinction to make. Not Israel Lebanon war, Israel Hezbollah war. They went after Hezbollah and really took a lot of them out, and they did damage Lebanon, but not the way they will damage it next time. Because subsequent to that, Israel said to Hezbollah, you're in the government now. So consequently, if we come again, this time it's against Lebanon because you're, part of the government. So the Israeli action would be much more widespread up and down the country. And of course, Lebanon is suffering a massive economic crisis, has been for years. So if that happens at that point, Hezbollah, desperate to survive, has a difficult decision. How much of its arsenal does it use? Now, it's thought to have 150,000 missiles, all of which can reach Israel, and among them, possibly tens of thousands, but certainly thousands of guided missiles. And this is the big difference. Israel has never suffered attack by guided missiles. And what I mean is that if they're going to try and hit the Knesset in Jerusalem, and they fire enough rockets, and the Iron Dome is overwhelmed, they will hit the Knesset, or they will hit Tel Aviv, Ministry of Defense, they'll hit what they want to hit because it's guided. And Israel has never faced that before. But, and here's the end of the answer, is Hezbollah's missiles are Iran's safety net. And what I mean by that is that if Israel woke up one morning and said, let's attack Iran, I'm not saying it's going to or even wants to. If and when it does, part of the Iranian response is to press the button for Hezbollah to send 150,000 missiles over. If Hezbollah have burnt those missiles, Iran's safety net has partially gone. So all these calculations would come into effect.
Where does the nuclear calculation fit in terms of Iran getting
Well,
close,
they are.
getting close to a bomb?
Yeah. The experts say they are within, if they chose to, several months of having a nuclear warhead. And that's because they enrich uranium. Because Trump took America out of the Iran nuclear agreement. At that point, Iran argued, well, hang on a minute, you've abandoned it. We are no longer constrained by it. And so they upped the level of enrichment. There's enrichment when you spin the centrifuges to enrich to a certain degree, which can be used for civilian fuel, for heating. And then you go all the way up, forgive me, nuclear experts, something like 95%, whatever it is, to get the level of enrichment that you need for weapons grade material. And they've gone somewhere between the two, like roughly from between 20% and 95%. Forgive me if the figures are wrong, but so they've enriched, and this is the hard bit, to get up to a certain point, for example, 65, 70% purity. Apparently, from there to weapons grade is a fast sprint. Then you can stick it in a warhead and then you can deliver it. So they are several months away. And as far as the experts say, they don't think they have yet set off on the sprint.
Now, the context is obviously the US election. I mean, this is all happening in, the backdrop of potential return of Trump. And I think it's fair to say that the American political establishment is somewhat distracted at the moment. What do you think the American approach will be to this? Is it simply to hope that they can hold all these sort of ver that all of these various parts stay essentially constant for the rest of the year, that that Israel slightly backs off on Gaza, that there isn't a war on the north, on the northern front, and that the Iran thing is sort of is held at bay as well?
Yep, they're spinning all those plates at the same time and others, South China Sea, Philippines, China, each other's throats.
So
People are looking
the
at.
goal is to avoid further
Yes.
conflict or conflagrations
To avoid
breaking
anything
out,
happening that derails what they're really concerned about, sadly, this year, and
which is the
understandably, that's
election.
the election. And of course, everybody around the world is that dislikes America is hoping to find some space in which to play. Notably, the Russians. It's Putin's re-coronation this coming weekend. It'll just be interesting to see by how much he decides he's won. And the death of Russian democracy is sort of sealed. I mean, he's waiting for. Sorry, I've sidetracked myself. He's hoping Trump gets in, Trump pulls the rug from underneath Ukraine, other people follow suit. They have to go to the table from a really weakened position. But yes, that Biden is trying to spin all these plates at the same time. There's only so much diplomatic bandwidth that you have when your top team focuses, and it's really, really difficult for them to be focusing all across the spectrum. Which of these will blow up? There are people that think there's going to be a China-Taiwan crisis. I think that's perfectly reasonable possibility, but I don't think it means there's going to be the China-Taiwan war. What will happen in Ukraine will happen in Ukraine with or without America, because the aid budget is stuck, and it's already led to, or it's assisted already, things like the town of Avdiivka falling. Russians are now advancing slowly in five different areas, and this is partly because that budget is stuck and the munitions are not getting through. And again, sorry, and this is directly related to the US election, because the budget that was going to go through a couple of months ago to fund Ukraine's military was packaged up deliberately by the Republicans in a bigger budget, which included money for the southern border because of the migration crisis. And Trump has deliberately held it up by getting the Republicans, the MAGA guy, people in Congress, because he wants it to be worse until he comes to power, and then he solves it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's strange, isn't it? This, how the Mexican border is related to the Ukraine war.
Well, it's all connected. And I mean, final question: you said there that you'd sidetracked us, but actually by mentioning Russia, but I don't think it is a sidetrack at all, because these things are clearly, as you've described very well, connected. To what extent, and there's a lot of debate among historians and strategists at the moment, to what extent do you think the autocracies, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, are coordinating their activities? Is that the case, they are coordinating, or is it accidental, opportunistic, or some combination of the two?
It's a really good question, and I think it's a combination. I mean, you know, it's not that the leaders of several countries get together and plot. It's more an understanding. I mean, I would take it back to round about the turn of the century, when it was pretty clear that China and Russia realized we are now becoming strong enough, notably China, to begin to push back hard against the post-Second World War order, which was written mostly by the Americans and the Bretton Woods institutions. And lo and behold, and I don't think this is deliberate, but then in comes bin Laden, enters the frame. Twin Towers, America completely sidetracked for two decades. It goes off to Afghanistan, goes off to Iraq, economic bandwidth, diplomatic bandwidth, political bandwidth, blood and treasure spent in areas which are not deeply strategically important to the Americans. And the Chinese and the Russians are loving it and expand their influence everywhere that they can. And I think that is a thought out policy, especially once you get Xi and Putin in together. And it's been very successful. And then you get the other autocrats, that's North Korea, Iran. I mean, the Iranians and the Russians, you know, what have they got in common? Dislike of America. So this is all these marriages of convenience are going on across the world by the autocrats, who can see an uncertain America, which is going through turmoil domestically. So, you know, it's not smoke-filled rooms and sign here. It is an understanding of a common theme, which I do think has been quite successful. Now, Biden's big, if he has a big foreign policy strategy or even doctrine, it is that the advanced industrialized democracies must hang together or they will hang separately against the autocrats. And I actually think that is one of the big picture themes of this century so far. And I don't think so far the advanced industrialized democracies are winning. And I think as the century progresses, we will see more of this. And it's going to take a revitalized, confident, energetic United States that doesn't talk about throwing its NATO allies under the bus the way Trump did recently, to hold the line and then push back that the advanced industrialized democracies, for all their failings and hypocrisies and sometimes brutality, and you know, all the long shopping list we can have of criticisms. But if you have to choose between the lesser of two evils, and I don't even think that one of them is evil, then that's the one to back.
Certainly the preferable system, but
preferable one. But it will take an energized, confident America, because Macron is not the answer.
Yeah, preferable is, to put it modestly, politely.
Yeah.
But it seems to be that we're in a situation where, as you've described, that's a very clear description of what is happening and what the story of the last 20, 25 years really means. But we're at that stage in the development of the crisis where I think not many people, I mean, in the general population, I don't think it's widely understood what you've described there and what the West, for want of a better term.
That's a generational thing, though, Ian, because, you know, the post-Second World War generation kind of got it because they'd experienced it. Mm-hmm. Cold War, when the depravities of the Soviet Union, which was, you know, the Russian Empire by another name, was obvious. And then this holiday from history, which, you know, many, many people have now experienced without realizing that it's a holiday from history, thinking that the last 30 years is the norm, whereas in fact it's not, and therefore not realizing that it can be chipped away at year on year on year until, oh, you're in a situation where, and I'm not sure if I agree with the Defense Secretary Grant Shapps' statement that we're in the pre-war years. I mean, we can't know, but I think we are in a situation now where if we take the wrong decisions, we may lead towards conflict, not just in areas which we thought already was unthinkable, Europe, which was so naive to think there wouldn't be war in Europe. You know, I was in Bosnia in 95, 93. Mm. Yeah, if we take the wrong decisions, that is the road that we're heading down. I suspect there's a slow realization dawning on the educated classes.
Yeah, I think you're right, but isn't it curious that no politician yet really, I mean, maybe Boris did on Ukraine and Sunak has periodically spoken in these terms, but no one has yet really actually nailed that, nailed that description as you nailed it there and said, look, this is what the West, which does include countries which don't traditionally think of themselves as being the West, but the allies, the democracies, this is what we're up against. This is not it's not a sort of temporary blow up in the horrors of, it's not just about the horrors of Ukraine. There is something even bigger connected going on here. And our politics, our public spending, the way we think about the world, supply chains, all of it is going to have to be different, because it's not an 18 month effect. This is the next two or three decades.
I think there is a slow realization dawning in the political and in the wider educated classes that that's where we are. I think one of the reasons why it's so hard to come to grips with this after this holiday from history is that if you take a, for want of a better word, hawkish view on this, you're seen as not being a liberal. And in the wider academia, media, and to an extent politics, you know, liberalism is the default position. And I think people are a bit reluctant to believe that there is a threat to democracy that requires a robust position to be taken, because I think they're worried about, people will think I'm in a horrible sort of right-wing fascistic type, and so they just keep stum, which I kind of understand, but it's also a bit of sort of moral cowardice. You can take the view this is all overblown, the scaremongering, warmongering, you want defense budgets, I just think you look at the 20th century and history, you look at the behavior of some of the autocratic countries, notably Russia, less so China up to a point, and with the caveat of our hypocrisies and some of the behaviors that the West has done, you can take that view, but for me, the warning lights are blinking.
Tim Marshall, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, a podcast where we discuss politics, geopolitics, economics, culture, ideas. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website. You get my weekly newsletter, Tim's column on geopolitics, all manner of other great things produced by the Reaction team based in London. Until next time, thank you for listening.